Hello and welcome to the Arsenal beat, or should that be the Varsenal beat, after what we witnessed across the Premier League over the past weekend. Arsenal, one of several teams to be on the receiving end of a poor decision. So we'll be talking to ESPN editor and VAR expert Dale Johnson to work out how and why such errors can still occur in football's technological age. Goals Charles Watt and Nick Callow from Haters are also here to discuss the VAR call in the draw with Brentford, as well as other matters such as the performance, the upcoming Manchester City clash, and of course, to pit their wits against our guest, the Gooner Quiz. But we'll start, first of all, Dale, with that big VAR call from Arsenal's draw with Brentford, which allowed Ivan Toney to equalise and leave the Bees getting a point from the Emirates. Just how has it happened? And try and explain the process that has led to everything that has fallen out here, and obviously Pedro Mel coming out and apologising for the situation.
Right, so there's two parts to this offside decision, and it's really fallen down, I guess, on the first part, which is when Lee Mason's looked at the possible offence by Ethan Pinnock with Gabriel. Now, what he looks at first of all is it a foul? Is there a blocking action there? And there wasn't really enough in that to be considered a blocking action, so then he moves to offside. Now, if he judges Pinnock is offside, then that's a pretty easy decision because it clearly has an impact in Gabriel's ability to get across and close down Toney for the cross. Now, the problem was that he spent 2 minutes and 20 seconds looking at, first of all, the possible block, and then the offside. Now, Gabriel's body was obscured by Pinnock, so he couldn't actually see for certain where Gabriel's arm was. So he couldn't apply the offside line, so he couldn't make a judgment on that situation. Now, we can probably all agree that Pinnock was probably offside, but Mason can't actually make that call. So he was correct on this one to go with the on-field decision and move on to the next phase. And the problem was when he did the rest of the attacking phase, he must have thought he'd spent so long on that first one that he only spent 15 seconds and ran through the attacking phase once and totally missed that Christian Norgaard had come back from an offside position to onside to then go and play the ball across for Toney to equalise. So it wasn't the case of he didn't apply the offside lines or forgot to apply the offside lines on Norgaard. He just didn't see he was a possible offside. And when you consider that this wasn't just like an insignificant moment within an attacking phase where one player may just have come back from offside, you don't quite notice it. This was a guy that created the goal. And you should never miss. I find it incredible that he's managed to miss a possible offside against the player that has created this goal.
Yeah, I mean, what's going to happen with Mason? I think we've seen reports overnight and this morning that Howard Webb has called the referees to Stockley Park to some sort of meeting to go through what happened. I know we've seen in the past, obviously, referees get taken off matches, demoted. Do you have any sort of sense of what could happen to Mason as a fallout from this?
Well, I mean, what Lee Mason's long-term future is, we'll have to wait and see because he's just got a catalogue of errors, really, in the 2 years since he's been a full-time VAR. Now, PGMOL aren't saying anything about any official of anything that's happened this weekend. But we will find out tomorrow when they release the appointments for the next weekend. And we'll see if Mason's there and John Brooks, who was at Brighton, and Neil Swarbrick, who was at West Ham Chelsea. We'll see if those three officials do actually make an appearance. But of course, one of the issues is that's two of those three, with the other being Neil Swarbrick, are full-time VARs. This is their only job. They should be the best of all the referees that are doing this job. Yet they've been responsible for around half of the mistakes, that's wrong interventions and missed interventions, that we've had all season. And it just tells us, really, that there's no point taking a retired referee and put him in the VAR room just because he's retired and he's experienced. These people need to be properly good at identifying errors when they are watching replays, which is a totally different skill set to what they've been using when they've gone through the ranks to become Premier League referees.
Yeah, we got a little glimpse of it at the World Cup of the sort of semi-automated offsides. Is that where the Premier League is going? Is that the next step? And for those fans who, you know, might not have fully understood how they worked at the World Cup, what's the difference between that and using what's currently in place in England?
So they started using this in Serie A 2 weeks ago because of a massive VAR offside error early in the season there. And what this does is it tracks all 22 players on the pitch and it removes the human aspect of an offside decision. It means that you can't miss a player, you can't have a player obscured by another player, so you can't draw the lines and you can't forget to check a player. There's an automatic alert when the ball is touched that a player is in an offside position, and that comes up on the screen in the VAR, and then they then judge if that player is active or becomes involved in the play. Now, positive is you remove the human element. The negative is that it is a much more accurate technology, and so you're getting far more marginal offside calls. There's been a few in Italy, in the first 2 weeks, whereby you see it side on, and you really can't be sure which part of a player is offside because it's so tight. There was one offside involving, I think it was Juventus a couple of weeks ago, Inter Milan it was, and it was Martinez again who had a similar one at the World Cup. And basically it was the side of his head as he was looking across the pitch, it was offside. So it was just the very top, it was like basically like his hair was offside. And so while we want to remove this human element of getting really bad mistakes, there will be a sort of a payoff with that, whereby there will be slightly more marginal offside decisions, which we see in games.
Nick, you were obviously in the press conference after the game. Looking back at some of the videos and the transcripts, the offside calls dominated the press conference. What was Arteta's mood like and how did he react to the situation?
I mean, I think it was the first question, wasn't it? Because I think just sitting in the press box, I mean, Dale just explained that so well because I don't understand offside anymore. But looking at the instant, when the goal went in, I thought that's probably a goal. Maybe they'd see what VAR did. And as soon as you saw saw the ball come into the box, well, there's two players offside there. And I think you were sitting in front of me, Simon, and said, well, either that's offside or I just don't understand the offside rule. So I presumed it probably was not going to be offside because I don't understand it anymore. And then so Mikel was asked about it. And he said, well, yeah, it was offside. And there was just, it was just a bombardment of questions. Wasn't it? Just people just come to get to talk about it a bit more, make it into a bit more of a story because I thought he handled it pretty well because he didn't get angry. He just said, well, it was offside. I can't do anything about it. I can complain. I can report the referee, the Lee Mason, whoever you want, but nothing's going to change that decision. And he was just very quick to move on from that subject, if you remember. That's how I felt anyway. I think the reason he wanted to do that was because he probably realised that Brentford had been, well, they had the better chances in the game. Hadn't necessarily been the better team. But in a way, a draw was not an unfair result in that match. And he needed to get those players thinking about playing Man City, a much bigger game, and the next target. And why dwell on these decisions? I mean, we're dwelling on it and talking about it. It was clearly offside, but there's nothing we could do to undo it. And you know, you can't unless you replay the whole game from the start. And then who knows what's going to happen? I mean, it's really fascinating here, Dale. Talk. I mean, I was never a fan of having VAR introduced in the first place. The ball over the line for goals is where I draw my line, metaphorically, literally, and that's enough for me. And I thought Arteta handled it quite well. He was obviously angry, but you know, he seemed to move on from it quite quickly, if that answers your question, Si.
It does. And Charles, I mean, we both sat through plenty of Arteta press conferences. How do you think he will approach this ahead of Man City? Do you think he'll be quickly putting it to bed? Or, you know, we've seen him at times, he has gone for officials and, you know, stuck the boot in. Or do you think he'll want to try and put this to bed and move on? What do you think his approach will be this week?
I think he'll probably try and put it to bed and move on just because of the size of the game on Wednesday night. I don't think he'll want to. There's not really much he can do now, is it? It's in the past. And I think the focus has to be on Wednesday night because it's so big. I think it'd be interesting. I mean, his press conference after the game at the weekend, I think his mood would have been slightly different had he known at that point that the offside lines just weren't drawn and that Lee Mason hadn't actually done the job he was supposed to be doing. I think his mood would have been very, very different because it seemed like his main argument was about the initial offside and the blocker, rather than the actual goal, because he, like, I think we all presumed that although we didn't see the lines, they must have checked those, and it must have just been like the angle that the camera was at that made it look offside, but they must have checked and it actually wasn't. And he kind of said that in one of his answers, didn't he? So I think he would have been in a far worse mood had he known what had actually taken place in that one. But I think just tomorrow's presser, it's just in the past, isn't it? So he can't do anything about it now, and he'll know he won't want any more unnecessary distractions ahead of City. All his focus is going to be on that. And I'd be very surprised, knowing the way he operates, if he makes a big song and dance about it again now with that game against City just looming so large.
And we've spoken about Arsenal, Dale, but there were plenty of VAR decisions. We saw PJ Mel apologise to Brighton as well. Just for those Arsenal fans who've been focused on that Brentford game, rightly so, what else took place this weekend? And obviously we know you write every week about sort of VAR decisions and errors. Imagine you've had a pretty busy Monday morning, or will have a busy Monday.
Yeah, definitely. Across these decisions. The Brighton offside goal, which shouldn't have been offside, it's really confusing how they've managed to get it wrong, because basically you've got two defenders, one in front of the other on the camera angle. And now they've started the process correctly, whereby they've drawn the vertical line up to the furthest point of the player. And that line is actually correct in terms of where it goes up. But rather than stop it on Mark Gahey, who is the correct player, they've stopped it on the arm of James Tomkins. But they've stopped it on his arm in a totally the wrong place, in terms of it's in the middle of his arm. If you carry the line up, it goes to the correct place on Gahey. The problem is once they've stopped it on Tomkins, they then draw the line to Tomkins' feet. He's a wrong player. So in effect, they've created a 7-foot-tall player to draw the offside line, which is too far back, which then means that Stupinan is offside when he should have been onside. So they've started it and then totally lost concentration by putting the first line on the wrong player and then creating the wrong offside line. So it's just, you remember, there's two people doing this. You've got a Hawkeye replay operator who is applying the lines, but he's applying the lines and saying to the VAR, is this correct? So you've got two people here, not just one, who've managed to mess this up completely. And the other big one, now this wasn't part of the PGOML's statement yesterday about a mistake, which was a penalty which Chelsea wanted for a handball by Thomas Suchek. Now this was definitely a penalty. He wasn't his supporting arm. He was clearly diving to his right, almost making a save, and his arm went down into the path of the ball. Now, this wasn't in part of the apology, because there is a subjective explanation why Neil Swarbrick could decide that it was a supporting arm, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the incorrect decision not to give the penalty. And PGMOL will be in the list of mistakes when it goes to the clubs on Thursday, that it should have been a spot kick. The worst thing about that one, the Chelsea one, I think, was it was just so quick. And Neil Swarbrick had taken like a minute and a half over an offside decision 6 minutes earlier. Then you got this penalty, and it was like a 10-second check and play just continued. And this is Neil Swarbrick, who is actually the Premier League's head of VAR. He's been the head of VAR for almost three seasons now. And it's incredible that he was also the VAR who failed to give Fabinho the red card against Brighton in the FA Cup. Now, if you've got the person that's running VAR who can't make correct VAR decisions on really high-profile incidents, then you can see the whole problem that Howard Webb has in turning around the general way refereeing and VAR's work in the Premier League.
Well, look, Dale, thanks again for coming on. I'm sure you're going to have a very busy week, so we'll let you jump off. But yeah, thanks for your explanations. And, well, I guess for Arsenal fans, hopefully we won't have you on again. But for us on the pod, we'd love to have you back another time. Thank you.
No worries. Cheers, guys.
We will move on to some chat around the game, which... it almost got lost a bit in the VAR controversy, Nick. But what did you make of Arsenal's performance as a whole? You spoke a bit about how Brentford will feel like they could have come away with all 3 points. What was your take on it and the way Arsenal played, particularly after that result at Goodison Park where they were beaten by Everton?
Yeah, I mean, just to finish on that VAR thing, it is ridiculous that we would be talking about an Arsenal win, wouldn't we? But not just a sort of a borderline sort of bad decision, just a complete... unbelievable cock-up. And would that change the narrative of what we're going to talk about now? I would say possibly not, because Arsenal were not good on Saturday against Brentford. Not good by their standards anyway. They still probably did just about enough to win, but Brentford has some really good chances. There's this sort of narrative that, because Mikel's been picking the same team, he's been very lucky with injuries, which should be a benefit, that they've been a bit easier to work out because they're more predictable. And Thomas Frank was saying afterwards, well, of course, you know, you have to put two players on Martinelli and double up on Saka as well. And that sort of helps nullify them. And he knows how they're going to, their sort of patterns of play. Do they sort of make changes for Wednesday? I guess we'll come on to that a bit now. I just thought they just looked a bit nervous. I mean, for me, it's just too early in the season to be nervous if you're going to challenge for the title, because these games should be coming up in April, even May, but the crowd, the atmosphere was tense. The Brent, always the away fans are going to be singing at any match and at any level of football, but the Arsenal fans have been fantastic for the last couple of years, but they were so quiet because I think they were edgy, and as soon as they saw Brentford were coping quite well with Arsenal's early attacks, they went quiet. Arsenal sort of looked a little bit edgy. They weren't moving the ball with the same sort of fluency. And Mikel sort of, that's when he looks a little bit foolish, is probably the sort of strong word, but when he's sort of trying to sort of deny the blatant truth, when he said, there was no nerves, the crowd were behind us all the time. And they did get behind the team. I mean, they did get behind them more in the second half. Arsenal started playing better. So you can see why that 12th man thing is not just a sort of thing that we say and footballers say. It does have an impact on the passage of play. In a way, point was not a you could say it's not a disastrous result. They're going to have blips, and it's not a defeat. They should have won. They should have possibly won at Everton, but I think I was looking at before. I thought if they could go into that City game with 4 points from the Everton and Brentford game, they'd be in a really strong position. Now they go into the City game, well, they really can't. It feels like they really can't afford to lose it. City have got all the momentum, and I think the work that Mikel does between now and Wednesday is just going to be on the players' minds, just to get them feeling sort of confident again.
Charles, do you feel like teams have worked out how to play against Arsenal? I'm looking since we've come back from the World Cup break, and if you look at the similarities, obviously different teams, but Newcastle, Everton, Brentford, the blueprint they played of sort of doubling up on the wingers, swamping Odegaard, stopping Partey getting the ball from the centre-back seems to be how you stop Arsenal playing. And do you think, Nick touched a bit on there on team selection, but Arteta maybe needs to tweak something, if not City, but in the next few games, and the teams have sort of worked out how to play Arsenal?
Possibly, but then I don't think, it's not exactly rocket science, is it? I can't imagine that no team has thought of that before Newcastle or before Everton. I mean, it's pretty clear where Arsenal's threat comes from. It comes from Saka, it comes from Martinelli, making the pitch as wide as possible, and Odegaard pulling the strings in the centre. It's just that some teams haven't been able to deal with that. I think also those three teams that you mentioned, they're probably the three, certainly Brentford and Newcastle are two of the best teams are playing that way because of the players they've got and the way they play. Everton, obviously, it was the Dyche factor, and Arsenal weren't good at Everton by any means, but I think it was the kind of dice factor as well. So I don't know. I think we'll have to wait and see how it pans out over the next few games. The thing is, Man City are certainly not going to play like that on Wednesday night. I'm not sure. We're looking further ahead, I'm not sure Villa are going to really play like that either, or Leicester the way they play. So we'll have to wait and see. I think they weren't great against Brentford by any means. They were better than they were against Everton. I just think Brentford are 10 games unbeaten in the Premier League now. They'd only conceded one goal in five games coming up to the Arsenal game. They've beaten everyone in terms of the big six really this season. Even City away. So they're a very good side. And, if Arsenal had won that game 1-0, that would have been a fantastic win. It would have been one of those ones, if you're going to win a title, you have to play those games where you don't play well and you find a way to win the game. I think back to, it's always a game in 2002 that sticks out, Arsenal-West Ham at Highbury, and it was in the running, and Arsenal were awful that day. West Ham should have scored. Canute had a shot that went over the line. Ashley Cole cleared it, and it wasn't given as a goal. And, West Ham were brilliant. They were all over Arsenal. And then about 70 minutes, Lundberg scored out of nowhere, and Arsenal won that game. It just always sticks in my mind of one of those matches where you don't play well, you're at home, you're expected to win, you really struggle, but you find a way to get over the line. And this would have been one of those games, I think, against Brentford. It would have been a really good victory against a good team where you struggled, but you found a way. And, that's why I just go back to the VAR decision. It's just an absolute sickener for Arsenal to lose 2 points like that because of someone not doing their job properly, that was so simple to do. And So I think the narrative changes, and you go into that City game on the back of a win rather than the back of a draw and a defeat, and again, it all changes completely. So for Arsenal, I wouldn't be getting too worried about it. I think there is definitely an argument for Trossard to be starting now. You know, it's Martinelli hasn't scored this year. He's clearly struggling for form. It's not the same player that we saw. It's certainly the first half of the season. And there's no surprise in that. He's played so many minutes. He had the World Cup trip. The whole reason you get these players and you get the squad is so you can rotate a little bit. And I thought Arteta missed a trick against Brentford. It just felt like the game to start Trossard and to give Martinelli a bit of a breather. So it wouldn't surprise me now if he does it on Wednesday night, especially after Trossard scored. But then you also look at the way City play and the way that Martinelli's caused them problems in the past and think, is he going to have more joy in a game like that than he would against Everton? And it's a big decision. He's got big decisions to make, but I wouldn't be too worried about Arsenal's form at the moment. You know, it can all change on Wednesday night. The narrative can change completely. That it's just a huge game. Huge game. Honestly, I think it's the biggest game the Emirates has seen.
We spoke in the mix zone, Charles, when we were down there about Eddie Nketiah, who is one of those who didn't have a great game. I mean, what do you put that down to? Was it just the fact that wasn't an Nketiah game? You know, there's limited space. It's essentially playing against three huge centre-backs. Probably an occasion where Arsenal are wishing you've got Gabriel Jesus in the squad.
100%. I think the last two games, you know, I think Arsenal have, without doubt, the two games that they've missed Jesus the most. The way that the two teams have played against him, Everton and Brentford, there's, you know, three giant centre-backs at Brentford, and you've got Eddie Nketiah in the middle there, and Arsenal swinging in cross after cross, and you just think it's not going to play to his strengths, and he just doesn't. He doesn't have the quality that Jesus has of dropping deep and pulling defenders out of position, creating a little bit of space for others to run into. And he's done really well, Eddie Nketiah, in Jesus' absence. But certainly the last two games, I feel like Arsenal have missed Jesus more in those two games than any other matches. And he would have made a difference. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you think back to the game at Brentford, 3-0 at the Community Stadium, and Jesus was exceptional. He gave him a torrid time in that game with his ability of drifting out wide, drifting out of the box, getting into the box. It was just, he did not give them a moment's rest. And I think it would have certainly caused them an awful lot of problems, and that would have created extra space for other players. So yeah, 100%. And that's not a criticism of Nketiah by any means. He's just not that type of player. And it's where they've definitely missed Jesus the last week or so.
Yeah, the small matter of Manchester City on Wednesday night. City can go top, given they beat Aston Villa 3-1 on Sunday. Victory means they'll overtake Arsenal on goal difference. Arsenal have finished top at the round of every fixture since the third round of games. So it'll be a big swing if City do that. Nick, Charles there spoke about this being probably one of the biggest games the Emirates has had. From games you've covered there, and obviously games at, you know, at Highbury as well, where will this rank in terms of big matches? If it feels like the sort of title games of old that Arsenal had, when normally against United, wasn't it, when they'd come to Highbury?
I think possibly bigger games might have been in Champions League, you know, that match against Man United, maybe one or two of the Barcelona ones. But but having the title almost on the line really takes it up a level, possibly. It just felt, you know, what was it? It was last season. It looked like Arsenal played so well against City at home, and they just couldn't get over the line. And even, you know, coming back from Manchester the other week, that FA Cup tie when City won, I felt Arsenal came. That was not a bad result for Arsenal. It sort of gave them one less fixture to worry about, which is sort of a bit glib sort of thing to say. But they played well. They weren't outplayed by City that night, and they played a sort of B team. And they should be going into this game full of confidence. But as you were saying, the last two results means they're going to be possibly going in a bit of a low ebb, which is why I'm just emphasising Mikel has got to, either by himself or some sort of psychiatry or hypnosis, to get into the player's mind to say, actually, you're good enough to take City on and to beat them. And it's, you know, he has to sort of get their minds off the fact that City are coming into a bit of form, all their best players are fit, and yeah, it's a huge, huge game, and Arsenal just can't afford to start slowly in it, can they? If they start well, I think they can finish well. What would you do? Is still in their hands, isn't it?
It is. But what would you do with the team, Nick? Sort of Charles spoke about Trossard for Martinelli, which that feels like the one change that you would possibly make given the form of Trossard and, you know, conversely the form of Martinelli. And also, I think the other debate people had before the weekend was whether Tomiyasu plays with Ben White. I actually thought Ben White did pretty well against Brentford. But what would you do? If you're Mikel, would you say, look, these are the players who've got me here. It's the biggest game of the season. I'm going to back the 11 that have got us to this point.
Well, what I would do and what Mikel would do, probably two different things. I would imagine that Mikel's sort of quite proud, not stubborn is too sort of strong a word, but he'd think, well, hang on, I need my best team against the best team and I can get them playing their best. And if you remember in that cup tie, Martinelli, when he came on, certainly in the second half, he terrorised that City defence. And I think Arteta will be thinking that he's got that in his head. It's a nice option to have because Trossard has looked fantastic. And he also had a great game against City too. So he knows that he can play well against that City defence as well. It wouldn't surprise me if he played Trossard because everyone's sort of saying to him, there was a lot of messages coming into him from us at the moment saying, you keep playing the same team. You've been worked out. And we know how Pep loves to change his lineup and try and spring a few surprises. And maybe I think, oh, hang on, well, I can do that too. You know, I may be a new manager-ish still, but I've got a few tricks up my sleeve. Wouldn't surprise me if he's tried Trossard, and it wouldn't surprise me if he's played Tommy as well from the start, because he's played him previously in games where we thought, oh, that's a bit of a surprise he's playing. He's come in at left-back, and I see some people saying Tierney should start ahead of Zinchenko as well, but I don't think you drop Zinchenko for a game like this at all, personally. So, I'm not going to sit on the fence, but I think possibly the most likely change would be to bring Trossard in and maybe Tomiyasu for White, as you said. But I'm glad it's not me making the decision.
I can't imagine he's going to make wholesale changes, is he? I think Ben White will play. I'd be surprised if Tommy comes in for it, just because I think Ben White, like you said, Si, I thought he played much better against Brentford. And I agree, it's just the Martinelli one. He's not going to suddenly spring major surprises and, you know, start Jorginho ahead of party or something like that, is he? I think it's just going to be Martinelli or Trossard. I love the idea of him hypnotising the players, Nick, London Colney before the game. That would make me
I'm not joking about hypnosis. I've been studying this quite a lot recently. So
you will beat Manchester.
For another time.
It might work. They need to do something given a record against City in the Premier League in the last 5 years. So maybe it'll work.
Yeah,
it's obviously the doomsday scenario, Charles. But if they do lose to City and they sort of, you know, flip places in the table, I mean, how do you think, obviously it's worth that place that City move above Arsenal. Arsenal fans should remember they've got that game in hand. But how is Mikel going to pick the team up after a result like that? And how big a result is this going to be, even though we've got 15 games to go? I know it still feels weird that we've got that far to go, but it feels like it's worth so much more than 3 points.
I think so. I think given that Arsenal have never been in this position before, it's just having that little barrier is just nice, because you know there are going to be slip-ups. They've had a couple. But if suddenly you're looking at the league table and you're actually behind City for the first time basically all season, you're thinking, oh God, and you've had the home games out the way as well, you know. So that's why I'm saying, I know Nick pointed to the Champions League semi-final against United, and I think that's the only one that you can really come close to. The Barcelona ones were massive occasions, but they were early stages. They were first legs. It wasn't a second leg. The semi-final, I think, is the only one that comes close. And unfortunately, that was the biggest anticlimax ever. It was over within 10 minutes, and hopefully this one won't be. So it's a monumental game for Arsenal. None of the players have been in a position like this before, and it's going to be intriguing to see how they cope with it and how the fans cope with it. And mentally, how Arteta would pick them up, we just don't know. They do have that game in hand, but it would be a big blow to suddenly, in the space of about a week, see a massive lead wiped away and suddenly see City ahead of them, a City team who we know got themselves over the line in so many seasons over the last few years in the Premier League. So mentally, it would be a big, big blow for them. It wouldn't be the end by any means. They'd still have a real opportunity of going on and doing it. But, you know, if they could win this one on Wednesday night and suddenly be 6 points clear again with a game in hand, I mean, it's just huge. It really is. It's very difficult to play it down, the significance of this one. It's a massive, massive game.
Yeah, I think Arsenal fans and maybe the players, but I don't know, have been sort of cushioning themselves by saying, well, look, top four was the target this season, and this is just a sort of a miraculous, lovely sort of run that they've been going on to be top at this stage. But they are, you know, I just said the title is in their hands. There's a hell of a long way to go. When you think of title run-ins in the past and going even back to sort of 89 when it looked like they'd blown it and then won it on the last day at Anfield. This is how title runs often go. You know, City won it with the last kick of the season, didn't they? When the Aguero won and so on. So they can afford to lose this and still be in the race. But I think it'd be huge if they lose it. It would feel like just forget it because City is going to
a draw would absolutely not be the worst result for Arsenal in this one. Bring Manchester United into the equation a lot more than they are now potentially, but I don't think it would be a disastrous sort of result by any means. It's for Arsenal, it very much feels like a do not lose game. For City, it kind of feels like for them a win would be difficult for Arsenal to potentially come back from. But so I think if Arsenal could come out of a draw, it wouldn't be bad. Obviously, you want to win, you want to open up that gap again and give yourself a little bit more breathing space. But from an Arsenal point of view, it's 100% a do not lose game.
Yeah, I know Mikel likes to play down the significance of games, but I think he's going to struggle to do that in his press conference. Right, from one big game to another, it is, of course, Guess the Gooner. I'm going to let Nick have the first guess after the first clue, and then Charles will guess first after the second, and so on. Let's play. I scored one goal in 15 caps for my country.
Ray Parler?
It's not Ray Parler, sadly.
Francis Jeffers?
It's not Francis Jeffers.
Well, went without the clue.
Right. Second clue. Charles, go first this time. I played in the third, second and first divisions, as well as the Premier League.
God, this is another one of Brian's blooming journeyman lower league player. Paul Dickov.
It's not Paul Dickov.
Lee Dixon.
Not Lee Dixon. Right, third clue. Nick to go first. I have worked as a coach at MK Dons, Huddersfield and Southend.
Bloody hell.
Quite the CV.
MK Dons, Huddersfield, Southend. Played for England and Arsenal. Scored a goal. I just don't know. Can't even guess. Sorry.
You're going to pass, Charles?
I'm going to pass it.
Paul Shaw.
No, incorrect. Clue number four, Charles to go first. Three different clubs broke their transfer records to sign me.
Wow.
Three different clubs.
John Hartson.
Incorrect. Nick, on stab.
Transfer records, blimey. My mind goes to David Platt, but he's definitely scored more than one goal for England. And I don't remember him being coach at all those clubs.
I did manage to get
Dol Campbell?
Incorrect. But I did use all the clues to get it. I've lost track what clue we're on, but it's Nick to go first. I reached number 68 in the UK singles chart with my one and only single. There will be a bonus point at the end if you can name the single, which I did manage to do. I'm very proud of.
Right, so it's not like really going way, way back then. Name the single. Actually, that's more confusing than helpful, that clue. Aren't they supposed to get easier as they go on? Is it something like... Someone like John Samuels played, had a single in that sort of 70s era, but gone. Is it John Samuels?
Incorrect. Charles?
Honestly, the only person I know brought out a single was Wrighty, but it's, you know, Wrighty scored more than one goal in 15 games for his country, and no club broke the transfer record three times to sign him. Jeez, I wouldn't even have a guess after that one.
Okay, next clue. Charles, go first. I've won the three major domestic honours in England.
Honestly, you haven't even given us any sort of hint of when he played for Arsenal or anything. There's no years, there's nothing to go on here. Won all three major honours.
Last two clues, I think, is when I got it. We've got four left after this.
Oh, God.
No, I don't know. Keep going.
Nick?
What was the clue? I've lost interest.
I have won the three major domestic honours in England.
Okay, so it's relatively recent then. The title and the two cups.
You want another clue?
Yeah, go on.
I was also named PFA Young Player of the Year during my career.
Merson.
It's not Merson. Nick?
God. No.
I've won...
It's great listening, isn't it? I suppose people have got this after the first clue.
I've won the Champions League.
Oh, you bastard.
There's no Arsenal link to any of these questions. This is Guess the Gooner.
Right, two clues left. I'm just going to let the floor be open.
Okay, go on.
I made just two substitute appearances for Arsenal before leaving the club in 1992.
In 1992?
Left in 1992, he made two substitute appearances. You must know who this
is.
You
said he won the league and the cups for Arsenal.
Never said he won them for Arsenal, just said he won. I think the last clue will open it up.
When did he leave? He left in 1992.
Left in 1992, he made two substitute appearances for Arsenal. And then clearly went on to have an absolutely glittering career.
Yeah, that's
Go. Andy Cole.
It's Andy Cole.
Oh, he gets the ball and he scores a goal. Well done, Charlie.
Andrew Cole. The final clue was I scored two more Premier League goals than Sergio Aguero. Bonus point, if either of you know his hit, I don't know, hit's probably the wrong word, UK single that came 68 in the charts.
You remember it, do you, Simon? That's amazing.
He's actually on a podcast I was listening to, not this one.
Oh, well.
And the song is called Outstanding by Andrew Cole. So work there, yeah.
It's an original number. It's not a cover.
It's an original number, yeah. On your Tube to Soho, Nick. Just get it in your earphones.
Oh, thanks. I was going to listen to this.
Does it live up to the title?
The fact it got to 68 in the charts, which I didn't even know they charted outside the top 50, suggests no. Not quite as good as his career. But anyway, guys, thank you very much for playing. Hopefully Wednesday night's game is a bit more entertaining than that. We'll be back after that to pick up the pieces of the Man City game and also look ahead to Aston Villa this weekend as Arsenal once again come face to face with their former boss, Unai Emery. But until then, stay safe, everyone.